Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Run Strong podcast with me, Gary House. This is episode 12, and in this episode, I talk open and honestly with Galen Reynolds, who is originally from Canada, now living in London, UK. We talk about his journey from being unfit and overweight to being one of the top mountain ultra runners on the circuit, all while living in the city, London, with his young family and building his busy business. Galen has a brilliant story to tell and is so easy to speak to that I hope you enjoy the conversation about the book that started his journey, family, his relationship with Montan, and lots more, his training, his achievements, and what's still to come. I probably could have chatted with Galen all day, to be honest, as a fan of the sport. So please check out Galen's Instagram, GalenRun, at GalenRun, as he's got a really unique way of putting out his race reports, I'd say, and they're really good to follow along. He's done some amazing races, got some amazing achievements, like I said, Tour de Géants, I think podium three times, second twice in a row, won the Dragon's Back last year, won the Trevyt Goat winter. So yeah, if you do enjoy this conversation, please subscribe, review the podcast, share it on your social network, however best to do you do that. And I'll get to do cool stuff like this more often and bring them to you. Okay, here is Galen Reynolds. Right, morning, Galen. I'm here with Galen Reynolds, and he's kindly agreed to spend a bit of his time and chat about training and his life as an ultra marathon runner, I guess you'd call him now. So, morning, Galen.
Morning, Gary. How are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. I guess, have you just done a school run similar to me?
Yeah, that's right. I had to rush back, you know. Most important thing of the day is to say, kids, you got to go quick because I got to go back and talk to Gary.
Yeah, I'm the same, but it was me that made us late this morning, actually. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to talk about all Galen's kind of, I guess, achievements at some point. But first, we're going to let everyone know how I met Galen. It was at Dragon's Back last year. First up was actually on day two. I don't know if Galen remembers. I was stood at the start line, kind of getting my kit sorted, and he'd just come up to the start day two, and I said, "Oh, hi, Galen, shook your hand." And I remember you looking at my race number, almost like checking my name, because basically I was leaving really late, and I think you were thinking, "Who's this guy? Am I meant to be kind of running with him or racing against him, kind of thing?" Because in my head, I think you were playing those games with Jim at the time, weren't you?
But yeah, definitely.
That's the first time I bumped into you. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I was just so focused, and then all the times that I would also see people out on the trail, I would also be like pushing quite hard and, you know, breathing hard and I try and chat with everyone, but it was so hard to have a moment. I'm like, "Hi, how you doing?"
Yeah. Especially when you're starting kind of last and you've got to work your way through everyone and everyone wants to say hello or something. Yeah. And then, I don't know if it was that night or that morning. I can't remember. We were in the food queue, and we basically had matching bowls. So we had,
yeah,
I had my
our kids' bowls, right?
Yeah, we had kids' bowls. It was just really
weird.
Yeah,
that's weird. So funny.
Yeah, it's like, "Oh, that's a good, nice bowl."
Yeah, nice dinosaurs.
Yeah, I think I had similar. So I had my daughter's bowl with me just as my food bowl. Worked well, though, didn't it? It was great. Have you done that
before? Oh, it was great. No, well, I was looking around because I was quickly trying to grab all the kit for the race, and I had missing a couple of things. I was like, "Oh, man, a plate." And I was just going to grab a porcelain plate, but obviously that's an awful idea. Yeah. So I was like, "Oh no, I don't have anything." So I just grabbed my son's bowl, which is the dinosaur bowl. But people are really jealous of it, I think, because it's super light and very durable.
Yeah, and everyone thought I'd kind of pre-planned it, like you said, but I was similar. I had some party plates up until, like, my wife Charlotte said, "No, don't take those, because what if they get wet or anything?" I was like, "Oh right, yeah, good idea." So I necked the bowl. Yeah. So family wise, how many kids have you got, Galen?
Got two kids. I've got two boys, 1.5 and 3.5.
Yeah. So mine are 2 and 4. Got a 2-year-old boy just turned and a 4-year-old girl. So it's probably pretty similar.
Wow. Yeah. Do they sleep?
She sleeps really well, actually.
Good.
You can't keep her awake past 7 p.m. and she wakes at like 6 a.m., which is fine. he's just up at 5 a.m. though, kind of, and he shouts, "Awake!" And it's like the alarm going off. And then you hear the gate go in, and he's up and he's gone, kind of thing. He's ready to go at 5 a.m.
Oh, man, that's rough.
I think there's such a difference between 5 and 6 a.m. I don't know what it is.
Definitely, yeah. Because like when my kids wake me up at 5 a.m., I'm way more frustrated and angry than when they wake me up at 6.
Yeah, and I don't go to bed late either. It's kind of, I'm asleep by 10, kind of thing. But so it's not like you're getting 4 hours anymore. It's still a decent night's sleep. It's just the 5 a.m. It just kills me off.
Yeah.
And work-wise, so you're down in London now, right?
Yeah, that's right. So my wife and I run a really small health clinic, pediatric speech and language therapy, that we have been doing now for 8 years.
And that is since, in case anyone doesn't know, you're originally from Canada, isn't it? Canadian.
Yeah, from Canada.
Schooled in America?
Did grad school in America, then came over here for a job. It was only supposed to be 2 years. My wife started the clinic about a year and a half into that job post. We were supposed to go back after the 2 years, but the clinic was only 6 months old at the time. So we're like, we'll just stay another couple of years and see how it is. And then 10 years on, we're still here.
Where in America was it you were based?
I was upstate New York, so a town or a city called Syracuse.
Okay. So you're used to city life, basically, aren't you?
Yeah, because I'm originally from Toronto, so that's a fairly big city, although, big suburb pretty much. But
yeah.
And then Syracuse is a city, so. And we love London.
Where's your wife from?
She's from out east in Canada, a very small province called New Brunswick.
Okay, yeah. But you love London, though?
Yeah, we love it here. It's although, I really miss the mountains and running on anything but pavement. But apart from that, yeah, we love London. The buzz of the city is fun and there's always stuff to do.
And do you think that's why, because your focus really is trail and then big mountains, isn't it? So is that why you haven't run any kind of, you're not a marathon runner or a road runner? Is it you're looking for the escape straight away?
Yeah, exactly. I think it's probably that. And I just can't picture running a marathon on roads. That's just really unappealing to me. And it's just, I think maybe even being back in Canada, when we get out of the city, there's tons of forest and trails, and we'd always be hiking as kids. Mm. And then just getting back to that, just being outside, being outdoors, getting away from it all, escaping work. And, I turn my phone off and just, it's awesome being out in the trails.
And how easy is it to get out on the trails from where you are?
Not very easy. No. So I always go to the parks in London, but then I try and get out to the countryside. I have some, my parents live out there, so I always try and get out there every weekend and just run out there, because it's, all the public footpaths make for such amazing running in this country.
Yeah. It's kind of like, looking back, I remember, so I'll go back. I actually knew of you from following the tour from when you, because you finished seventh.
Oh, okay.
The seventh, was it? First year you did it?
Yeah, that's right.
So you've done it three times, seventh, yeah. Seventh, second, and second. Is that right?
Yeah.
So I remember the seventh thinking, because I was just following general people that I kind of half knew. And and it was, to be honest, I hadn't heard of Galen Reynolds before. And then kind of, not that, I don't know, you wouldn't expect it to, would you? But because I'm such a fan of the sport, once I know a name, right. I kind of see it again, or I'll kind of go on DUV and see, what's Galen been up to, and that kind of thing. Like,
right.
So even,
yeah, exactly.
So way before the Dragon's Back and everything, it was, I mean, I'd already pinpointed this guy's going to surely win this thing, which is probably, I was probably more confident than you were.
Oh, definitely. I was just hoping for like a top 10 at the Dragon's Back.
Yeah.
And especially once I saw Jim coming back in, because he only jumped back in, I think, like with 2 weeks to go or something.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh no.
And it's a bit of the unknown, I guess, isn't it, competition wise because you don't really know. It's not a kind of, it's a runner's race, but there's so much involved. What I now realize is the kind of route choice and everything is massive.
yeah definitely, it's such a big thing. And following Jim, because I ran with Jim a couple of days, he would be like, hey, there's a shortcut over here or something. And we'd go and take it. But if I didn't have him, I wouldn't be taking these shortcuts. And I'd just be following my GPS line, making sure I just stayed on it. And I think following him actually, cut a lot of time off.
Yeah, I guess it worked both ways, didn't it? So you could help him kind of, rather than him run all day on his own and then kind of navigating some shortcuts and things.
Yeah, but also Jim's like an old school guy, so he has like an actual map out. And he's just trying to follow the map. So sometimes I'm like, Jim, my watch says we should be going left right now, and he'd be look around and be like, oh yeah, that's right, let's go left.
I ran with him a bit on day one, and it, you know what it was like once you get up into the mist. And I was following my watch, and he seemed to be zigzagging everywhere, but I thought, I can't just follow in his zigzags because he's probably trying to drop me at the same time. So I was running in more of a straight line, and he would disappear, come back to me, disappear, come back to me. I didn't know if it was either he was trying to just get away or he was genuinely just kind of thumbing the map, kind of rather than following my watch.
Right. Well, he had an epic misadventure on last year or 2 years ago at Dragon's Back, I guess 3 years ago now.
Yeah.
When he lost the lead by an hour or something on one day when he took a totally random route.
It was on that day three, wasn't it?
Coming off,
Cadair Idris, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't want to try and pronounce that second name.
I think from what he'd done is, I think because the previous one before that went the way that he went, so he just hadn't researched the fact that it had changed slightly. And he'd gone as if it was the year before, whether it was on purpose or just in his head or anything like that. And then he had to double back and lost a bunch of time, didn't he?
Yeah, definitely.
So going back again, so what I want to get to is people will probably now start to hear from you from the tour, Dragon's Back win, Cheviot Goat more recently. But I know for a fact, well, most of this, my learning from you is listening to the Montan podcast too as well. So if you want to learn more about kind of Galen's runs, there's the Montan one, isn't it? Further, Faster, Fitter or something like that?
Yeah, Further, Faster by Montaigne, their podcast.
So I won't kind of go over too much of that. Go and listen to that one. But running-wise, like your results, I've got your results here, funny enough. Go back all the way to 2012. Ultra Trail Southwest and the North Downs Way, which is 2012. So although that's 7 years ago, that's quite a big jump, isn't it, in 7 years, going to like second in the Tour Trice and, well, Tour de Géants, in case anyone doesn't know what that is.
So I think it all started just because I wanted to get into the UTMB.
Yeah.
Just to do an epic thing to get fit again, because I was really unhealthy coming back from grad school in the States. So I picked up the book and just in this extreme like adventure book, found UTMB. And then, you know, you have to get all the points. So I had to work backwards. And it took me from 2012 running that North Down A 100 to 2015 when I did run UTMB to get the points and then obviously get into the race. And it was about after UTMB, then I was like, I thought I'd stop running and just like do something else. But then I was like, wow, I actually really enjoy this sport because I started from hating it. I actually hated running. Like I couldn't believe people actually did it for fun. And I couldn't even run a mile when I started. So it was like really discouraging. So anyway, so after UTMB, I was quite, quite obsessed with the sport. And then I was like, well, actually, next year, I'm going to take this seriously. And I think it was around 2015 where I joined Strava and I joined a club. I think it was probably the Lakeland Club.
Yeah.
And I started looking at other people's training. And I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe people actually run 6 or 7 times a week. I didn't know that was a thing. Because I was running 4 days a week and I'm like, wow, I am really extreme. And now, obviously, I run 7 days a week, or exercise 7 days a week. But so then 2016, I kind of started taking it more seriously. The hours went way up from probably about 200 hours a year training to over 500. And that's kind of when, I was able to make some progress and really hone in on different aspects of training. As well as I went to a technique coach, Shane Benzie. Yeah. Who's a great guy, and I went to him the first time. He's like, just run back and forth on this line for me a little bit in his little cricket ground area. So I did, and even before he's like, okay, we're gonna do about 10. So when did a couple, he's like, hey, stop. I'm like, well, I've only done like 2. He's like, yeah, but this is a train wreck. I know where we can start right away. Okay. So I've been working quite a bit on my technique too. So then I think just the combination of an increase in training plus really focusing on my technique has. I've been fortunate enough to be able to sort of increase my overall standings.
And do you think from going from like a kind of, what is it, college or university over there, getting qualified, and obviously that's pretty intense, you found learning about the running technique and learning about training and all this kind of thing, were you quite excited by all that part, never mind just the running?
Yeah, definitely. I love the data. So like, and yeah, also when I got on Strava, you know, segments and your PRs on different stuff. And so you can really see your data and then you can see improvement over time, which I find super fascinating.
And do you look back a lot through, do you mainly use Strava to look back through things or?
I use it for my, everything, just training log hours. Cause I count in hours, how much training I'm doing, how many hours I'm doing. And I also look at vertical too. So yeah, between the two, it's just mainly Strava is my home for everything.
And before, like before 2012, so although kind of your first couple of races were leading up to that North Downs Way 100, had you done, because I've only got your Ultra results, did you do anything before the Ultra Trail Southwest?
Yeah, so it was me and my wife started running. Oh, she was my girlfriend at the time. When we moved over, we're like, oh, we got to do something to get in shape because this is just not healthy. So we started with a 10K, did a trail 10K, then did a half marathon, a trail marathon, and then into the Ultra Trail Southwest, which is a 60-miler, and then the North Downs 100 at the sort of August of that same year.
And kind of how, like when you say you're out of shape or unfit, how out of shape was it, are we talking kind of thing? Because you can't, because 100 miles for a lot of people is kind of a really long-term goal. And this came across on the Montan podcast. He kind of, I just did this, and this. But I think you were quite out of shape, right? When you first
Yeah, I was extremely out of shape. Like, think like really big belly laughs, eating like deep fried stuff. And, I know pounds. I don't think you do pounds though, do you? You just don't?
I
give it to you in pounds.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so I was 220 pounds. I'm not sure what that is though. And then now I'm about 165. It was pretty significant weight loss. Because even by the time I got to South Down Way 100, I wasn't at my weight now. I was probably about 170, 175 or so.
Yeah.
So I continually kept losing weight past that even.
And that when you picked up the book, did you pick up the book or did someone give you the book?
It was like, you know, like in the movies when they pick up the book and it like kind of shines and all the other lights go on. It was actually my wife gave it to me. She's like, okay. Here's a book as my birthday present. It's like, let's choose something from here to focus on. Anyway, in there, there's like the Norsemen and Gobi Desert and Marathon de Sable.
Yeah.
All these extreme things. And so but we looked for something that was semi-close and semi-accessible.
And is she happy she gave you the book or does she regret it now?
I think she really regrets it now. I haven't asked her actually. Yeah. That's a good question.
You'll get a knitting book next year.
Yeah, exactly. Or a looking after the kids book.
Yeah. Yeah, I think like I was always encouraged, but like similar to me, my girlfriend was Charlotte. We're now married and everything. She was massively encouraging when I first started just running. Now she's just, it's like, can't we just go on holiday without a run involved? Or can't we just go anywhere? Like, because I'll say, oh, how do you fancy visiting Scotland or something? She's like, why? What are you doing?
Yeah, it's the same. All of our family holidays revolve around races. She's like, can we ever go on a holiday that doesn't like lead up to a race? Because obviously I'm super particular about sleeping leading up to it and eating and stuff. And yeah,
it's like, it's not a holiday. You basically just want some support crew or something.
Right, exactly.
So you get the book, you decide on UTMB rather than all the other things. How do you decide to go about it from going from the book to run one kind of thing? Was it just as easy as, right, I just need to go for a run? Or was there some kind of, were you nervous about the first run?
Yeah, super nervous about the first run. So I put on my, like, American basketball shorts and, I think it was a cotton t-shirt. Mm. And we just go out for runs and we were like, all right, well, we thought we were just going to walk UTMB and just try and finish it in the cutoff. And so we're like, well, we should just be able to run. Let's go run around this little loop that I can see outside here. So we did, and we were using back in the day, I don't know if it still exists, that Nike app on your phone, Nike Run or something.
Yeah, something like that.
And it was a really old iPhone I was using, like an iPhone 3 or something, or iPhone 4. So we went for the run, and it's like, oh, wow, we did 5 miles in an hour. That's great. Like, this is going to be no problem. But then we did the run the next day, and the GPS was just really, really off. And so we actually did like 2.5 miles in 1 hour. Okay, yeah. So we got really discouraged. Because when we started, it would be like run for 100 paces and then walk for 200 and run for 100 and walk for 200.
Talk to you in your ear, one of those kind of apps.
Exactly. It's like, you're doing great. This is your PR or something.
And then kind of, so you've gone, what I like is the attitude. It's like, oh, I've done 5 miles. Brilliant. Walking UTMB will be just, will just be fine.
Right. And this is prior to going over to the Alps before and never, you know, like knowing what it's all about at all.
I was going to say, because you've Toronto, New York, kind of, and then London, had you had any experience of the big mountains or any kind of elevation or being at altitude?
So I'd done a bit of the Rockies. A bunch during the summer and stuff, just going over for summer holidays.
Yeah.
But the Rockies are much different than the Alps. They're much less steep. And so, you know, they're really long and I don't want to say undulating because they're mountains, but they're not nearly as steep and technical. And so that was a total shocker when we started doing races here and then in Europe that are so steep and just so technical.
And which was the first kind of race that you thought, oh, actually, it's going to be quite tough, as in, like elevation or terrain, that kind of thing? Was there a particular...
Oh, man, that would have been the first 10K. We like, both were keeled over, like, panting. Like, and, like, stream of runners are going by. We're like, this is going to be tough. And that was just, like, in just outside of London somewhere, just on a trail. But in terms of elevation, I'm trying to think what the first one would have been. Oh, I can't think off the top of my head, but I think actually UTMB was one of my first mountain, serious, like alpine mountain races.
Yeah, you've done kind of UK-wise, Brecon 50, things like that, Ultra Brecon. So, and then Lakeland 50, and then was in 2015. How did you find Lakeland 50 when you got to there? Because that's, you're now 3 years into ultras, I guess.
Yeah, I loved it. I thought it was great. It's such a great event with so many people. So the atmosphere is awesome, especially with the 100 milers going off the night before. So, but in terms of terrain, it's quite runnable. I'm just trying to remember back to it. I think it's quite runnable, but obviously there is the elevation, about 3000 meters of elevation gain. But none of it is overly super steep and none of it's super technical. So, and then obviously the elevation is not over 1000 meters or something.
And as you're going along, so I know I'm kind of jumping backwards and forwards, but
right. First
couple of 10Ks and things or half marathons, was it just as soon as I finished a 10K, I want to jump in distance and then jump in distance again? Or did you think I could be going faster at this 10K or faster at this half marathon? Because a lot of people spend time at that distance or they just want a PB. Whereas from what I can tell, you were just focused on getting to, right, how do I get to UTMB or be prepared for UTMB?
Yeah, exactly. It was all about UTMB, I think, because I've only done one 10K in my life, and that was that one first 10K. And then the half marathon, we did one. We did do two trail marathons, and the way we just totally made it up, too. So, and like looking back, it's like an awful training regime. So we would do the 10K, and then a month from then, we had to do the half marathon, and a month from then, we had to do the marathon. And a month, we did another marathon, and then we did a 50-miler as well, that was semi-flat. I don't think it shows up there. 50 mile, then the UT, Ultra Trail Southwest. So it was 1 month, we would do up the distance every month, every...
So it's just progressive overload all the way along kind of thing.
Yeah, just brutal for, you know, injuries and everything. But I guess we just got lucky.
And were you always training and racing with your wife?
Yeah, that first year was totally together. She didn't do the 100 miler. Because she was screwing me, but she did everything else.
Okay. Did that make it easier, or at some point did you start kind of getting a bit fitter, and or the other way around? Was it just easier to be together, kind of thing?
Yeah, I think it was easier because when one of us was lacking motivation, the other one would be like, "Come on, you know, that 5:30 a.m. wake up to go running before work." It's like, oh, this is dark and wet and miserable.
Yeah.
No, we got to do it, you know. And then the next morning it would be me doing that. But then also during the races, because our only goal during the races was try not to come last.
Yeah.
And so we would be running together, and I think the same thing, we'd alternate who was having a high point versus low point. None of us was really fitter than the other at the time.
Yeah.
But then, well, actually, speaking of injuries, my wife started having a bit of a knee issue. And so that's why she kind of stopped. So maybe, you know, that was really bad doing all that build up. Because she hasn't been back since.
Okay. So does she still enjoy a run when she can? Or is it kind of, is running not part of her life as much now? Apart from when it's you.
No, it's pretty much nothing. Like, if anything, she'll try and go do some yoga or something.
Yeah. Yeah, my wife doesn't run. She can't stand it, kind of thing, which she loves. She loves the inspiration and being around kind of races and things like that. But yeah, you could never get her to run a couple of steps, kind of thing.
Has she ever done any races?
No. She's dabbled with running, but only kind of maybe because she felt she had to. She just doesn't like it, which is kind of good. She does other stuff. She like go swimming or go to the gym and things like this. But also, obviously, yeah, 4 and 2 year old, it's kind of, yeah, try and get her to do stuff that she will enjoy if she's got time, rather than trying to think,
right,
you don't have to go running. Plus, there's only kind of room for one of me in this family. Kind of.
I'll try that line on her and I'll see what she says about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, well, I see some couples and it's great and everything, but they do every run together and every ultra together, and it's kind of, I just can't imagine it, kind of thing, really.
Right. I think everything changes too when you have kids. It's just not even possible.
No, it's like I was really lucky that, I've always been self-employed and everything, but yeah, because you two are building up a business as well, I guess, at the same time as trying to, and then kids come along. So yeah, I guess you run out on the running stakes.
Yeah. Luckily. Cause she's actually super busy. She's more involved with the business now cause I can kind of move my schedule around and sometimes get some really solid training. And so, but she works like 14 hour days still. And, then also trying to take care of the kids with me. So,
yeah. And then, so UTMB is coming up. Do you just feel fitter and healthier and things like this? Are you confident going to UTMB, or are you just, or are you kind of starting to worry about this massive race looming?
Oh, I have like no confidence because this was the year that I joined Strava and was blown away that people trained so much.
Okay.
You know those leaderboard things they do in the clubs where, you know, top mileage is number one and so on. I was like last in all of these columns, and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to get absolutely destroyed. So I'm just, trying to say a bad word, but I was pooping my pants.
Yeah.
And I was so nervous when it happened.
You've listened to this podcast before, right?
Oh yeah. I was shitting my pants, and then I show up to UTMB, and Chamonix that week even is so intimidating.
Yeah.
Because there's so many super fit looking people with like the best gear. And I just moved on from basketball shorts, so I actually had running shorts now. So it was super intimidating, and the whole thing. And then I went out too hard and had a really bad sort of first half. But then it came around, and then, you know, you settled into, especially such a long 100, you settle in, and then everything, all the worries go away, and it's just, managing it and enjoying it and suffering.
And because you'd actually, like, progressively wise, you'd come fifth in the Lakeland 50 just the month before that year. Was that a surprise? Did that give you confidence, or did you think, did it almost give you too much confidence going into UTMB?
Yeah, so that was such a surprise because Lakeland is so competitive that I was actually hoping for about top 30, I thought, because I was watching the leaderboard. So I knew that my training was going up. Relative to however else was doing. So it came in fifth, and then I was like, oh, wow, I can't believe it. Like, that's crazy. I was so excited. But I don't think I got too ahead of myself because I knew that the UTMB was world-class. You know, like that brings runners from everywhere. And the mountains, I'd never run in such steep mountains before.
And was it...
So I tried it.
Go on.
What's that, sir?
And was it... So when you're kind of stood on the start line, did you feel out of place there still?
But I was late to the start line, so I was so far back, and I don't think I had time to worry about it. And also, the people actually the back of the pack of UTMB, some of them are like hikers, and so I was like, okay, I think I can do better than this hiker over here, you know, with boots on and stuff.
Yeah. So did you get stuck in a long line for a long time?
Huge conga line, and actually that's what led to my bad first half, because as soon as the conga line kind of breaks up, which is up that first climb, can't remember the name of it, but the first climb after the flat part. I just ran. I started running up the uphill, and like That was way beyond me at the time. And it just, I overheated and got dehydrated. And I was like going into rhabdomyolysis where I was like peeing blood. Which I didn't know what it was at the time. And I was so lightheaded. I could, everything was like white, had like a white filter over it. So I could hardly see anything.
It's probably good that you didn't know what was happening.
Yeah, definitely. Because afterwards I was talking to the medical team and I was describing it. And they're like, what did your pee look like? I was like, oh, it looked like coffee or Coke. And they're like, oh my gosh. And the worst part is every step would hurt because I guess it would shake my bladder. So like every step I took was like painful.
And that was, that's still in the first half of UTMB.
Yeah, that was the, that was even before getting into Italy.
So, yeah. What was going through the night there like? Because had you gone through a night ultra before? I don't think you had you? Or...
I don't think so. So I had no idea what was going to happen. And it was, I think there's so many people around, it makes it less weird.
Okay, yeah.
Because I was in the middle of the pack, kind of. So there's like, I never was alone.
Yeah.
So there's all people all around, you know, there's crowds around, the coals are covered in supporters. So it just kind of seemed normal. And I'd been watching the highlights on TV, on YouTube and stuff. So I knew kind of what it would be like, but it was such an unbelievable experience. I think the most shocking thing is that there's these little kids out on the top of mountains at 2 a.m. Yeah. cheering you on. And you're just like, what is happening right now? Like,
yeah.
How are you awake still?
I remember running a race up on Etna, Mount Etna on Sicily, and it was a similar kind of thing. I couldn't breathe. There was dust everywhere. You couldn't see anything. And then there was a 10-year-old, well, must have been no older than 10, and his dad just in like a Fiat Panda about over 3,000 meters high, just giving out Coca-Cola, and you're like, God, I need to get a grip.
They take it so seriously over there.
You think you're doing something extreme and there's just a kid stood next to you just like chanting away and you're like, oh, right, okay.
Right. Yeah, going mental with the cowbell.
Yeah. So after UTMB and you finish, because you've had this book for a good number of years now, haven't you? And that's your sole focus. How is it immediately after the UTMB and how do you feel the weeks after it?
Actually, I think it strangely felt a little bit like empty because I've been focused on this for so long. It was my one physical goal in life for 4 years or 3 years or whatever.
Yeah.
And then it was over all of a sudden. Mm. So, but although UTMB is a bit of a party even after you finish because we came back the next day. So there is like this kind of, euphoria feeling. But then I'd say the weeks after where you're recovering, you're sleep deprived, it's always like really down part of the season for me. It's tough to even get motivated to do anything work-wise, like anything.
You kind of lose all kind of like cognitive thinking and all that kind of stuff. And you're used to having direction with the running, which I guess frames everything else. That's how I always feel anyway. It's kind of... even though you know there might be a race somewhere else on the horizon, it's that first couple of weeks is you just feel a bit lost, I guess, don't you? And you can't.
Yeah, definitely. I always try and like pick something else up or sign up for another race so I have something to focus towards.
Yeah. So after UTMB, when did you make the decision that UTMB wasn't going to be the last ever run that you did?
It was probably in these weeks afterwards where I'm like, oh, I'm really depressed. I actually enjoy this, so I want to keep pushing. I wanted to do the Lakeland 100 because I did the 50 and I thought the Lakeland was such an epic race. And so did that, signed up for that race. Because I think the sign up is, sort of September around the time of UTMB.
Yeah. It's just
finishing,
think, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Then I wanted to train really hard and try and be competitive in that race. So that was the target.
So did you change your thinking from, I just want to do UTMB to, I think I can be competitive at Lakeland 100 and other ultras?
Yeah, definitely. So then I was like, okay, well, I did that. So now I want to try and, you know, up the training and see what I can do in a 100-miler and try it again. Because I made so many mistakes during the UTMB. I'm like, oh, you could change this, do this better. I think this works better for me. Because during the UTMB, so apart from the rhabdo, myelosis, when the sun came up again the next day, gels that I had previously been okay with, just the goos or whatever, I'd be eating goos, but I'd instantly have to go to the bathroom whenever I had a goo.
Okay.
And it was awful. And because UTMB is quite exposed. There's areas where there's no covering. So I would have a goo, and then I'd literally lie on the side of the trail, just like trying not to shit my pants.
All these pictures weren't in that nice, lovely, glossy book, were they, of this experience?
I need to write a new book. Yeah, this is what it's really like.
Go to UCMB and you get rhabdo and shit your pants.
Right, exactly. So obviously a lot of things that I want to improve. So try the 100-mile distance again. So that led me to the Lakeland 100.
How did you go about that, living in London? Were you kind of frustrated at the fact that you lived in London, or did you just see it as a positive you could make best use of living there?
Yeah, I don't remember it being too big an issue. Now it's when I'm doing the races in Europe that are steep and they kind of use different muscles that I can't engage unless I'm actually on steep stuff.
Yeah.
It started to become an issue. So I'd go over to the Brecon Beacons a couple times.
Okay, yeah.
For training camps or like training weekends leading up to the Lakeland. But I saw being in London, I think I was so focused also because the clinic was young, so it was taking up a lot of time.
Yeah.
So there wasn't much time really to think about it. So it was either working or running, and that was pretty much it.
And leading up to Lakeland, kind of, what were you still working on hours then, or had you kind of focused a bit more on mileage?
Yeah, it was mileage. I switched over to hours in, I think, the following year when I went for the tour for the first time.
Yeah.
Because I read a book, Jason Koop's training book.
Yeah.
And he says focus on hours if you're into mountain stuff. So I thought that was such a big kind of breakthrough for me because it made the training so much better. So when I would have on my own schedule, because I just make up my own schedule, and I've never actually had a real coach.
Yeah.
So it'd say 6 miles. And so I'd look at my watch and I'm like, oh man, I've got stuff to do tonight. So I'm going to run faster to get the 6 miles done. And then you're out of the zone you want to be in, or you're not doing the training you want. So now it's always like, okay, I'm going to run for an hour in Z2.
Yeah.
I find it much easier and you don't cheat your kind of your training plan.
And if you're doing like an out and back, it turns into like a progressive run because you just know.
Yeah, exactly.
And then so Lakeland 100, because otherwise we'll spend all day kind of going through everything. You did really well at Lakeland 100. You came sixth. In fact, that year, all the ultras you entered, you finished kind of top five, top six. So was that just the shift in increase in volume and training kind of thing?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think it was just an increase. And just also every year I'd read more training books. Pretty much any ultra training book that came out, I'd read it and sort of take on that knowledge. And since I like data so much, I would always kind of test stuff and kind of write down what worked.
Yeah.
So now, I guess, 2016. So it's been 4 years. So I've got 4 years of kind of testing stuff on myself. So I know what's working better and able to make changes.
And was there kind of, because then there's kind of a bit of a bigger jump because you think 2018 is Tour de Géants. When does that open for entry? So when did you decide I'm going to go into that one?
So then I did the Lakeland 100. I'm like, okay, I kind of got the idea of 100. So now I want to try something where I don't know if I can finish it. Something that's really challenging on every aspect. Mm. So I looked around and the Tour de Géant came up. And at the time, there wasn't a lot written about it.
No.
And the website was all Italian. The website wasn't very good. Still is not very good.
No.
So it's hard to understand. There's no like English race reports. So I couldn't even figure out for the longest time if it was a stage race or a single go. The information was so limited at the time. Anyway, I did figure out it was one go. So then I was like, I don't know if I can actually finish that. So that became really interesting to me. And that's what led me to signing up for it.
And when it came to things like researching kit and things like this, because you still hadn't done like big Alpine races, it was still just solely at UTMB, wasn't it, up until that point?
Yeah.
Did you enjoy researching what kit you'd want and testing all that out kind of thing? Was that part of the fun as well?
Oh, definitely. I love that kind of stuff. Just, searching out stuff and seeing what people are recommending, watching tons of YouTubes on what everyone's wearing and different kit that's coming out.
Yeah. And then so you kind of, and you took all that through Transvulcania, Eiger Ultra, and then Tour de Géant. So Transvulcania and Eiger, was that solely to kind of get some more mountain experience?
Exactly. Yeah, everything. So once I got into the tour, everything was in lead up to the tour. So I chose the races based on sort of steepness and vert to get ready for it.
And going into 2017 Tour de Géants, were you with Montan then, or was that, did that come after? Or how did that relationship start?
So the relationship with Montan started, 2017, I did the tour, just, you know, do my thing with my old hand-me-down Salomon bag that was falling apart.
Yeah.
And did that. And then after 2017, I was approached by Hoka, because they're a sponsor of the tour. Okay. And they heard that I was going to run the tour again. And they're like, oh, do you want to be an ambassador, which wasn't an athlete, which they made very clear to me, which is quite funny.
Yeah.
Because I was like, hey, they're like, here's some kit. And they gave me that random kit. And I was like, great. I'm like, I was so grateful to get Hoka kit.
Yeah.
And I got shoes from them. And I was like, so do you want me to wear Hoka kit for the tour? Because they gave me stuff that was kind of like summer, very light summer wear, you know, like singlets and stuff. So I was like, but if you do, just let me know. I'll wear the t-shirt or whatever.
I might need it.
They didn't even get back to me like by email. So I was like, all right, this is, I don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
So I did wear the shoes for the 2018. And then when I came in second in 2018, so then they got excited. And then they're like, oh, come in for meetings and stuff. Okay. And I'm like, man, I don't know. Like, you're not very good at communicating.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I really want to like work with you guys. And like the stuff they offered me the same deal for the next year coming into 2019.
Yeah.
Which was kind of like shoes, if you want whatever shoes you want. And then they'll give me random bits of kit.
Mm.
But I declined them. And then the way it came up with Montaigne is a guy I had met at the tour was a Montaigne athlete, Kevin Hatfield from the States.
Yeah.
So I got talking to him and I researched all the different companies. I looked at like Innovate, Montaigne, and even some of the American ones. And I found that Montaigne really, well, first of all, I had Montaigne kit from like the very beginning.
Yeah.
So for the first UTMB, I had the Montaigne Minimus rain jacket.
Yeah.
So I saw the races that they sponsored, and that's kind of like right up my alley. So then I got Kevin to introduce me to the guys at Montaigne, and I had an interview with them, filled out a couple application forms, and then they, approved me and let me on the team. So that was awesome.
Yeah. That's a lot kind of more, well, I guess it's natural, but just a better relationship from the start, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah. And it was much different than the Hoka one, where it was very informal and like, you know, they wouldn't answer my emails.
Yeah.
Whereas Montaigne, like they give you, there's like an agreement that you kind of sign. It's kind of like a contract, but you know, a bit lighter weight. And it lays out the expectations that this is what is expected of you. Obviously act like, don't be a lunatic.
Yeah.
Wear the kit, you know, that kind of thing. And here's what we're going to give you. So they give you a quota of kit that you can get, and then entry into any race. And then also there's other stuff that I'm actually pretty excited to work on this year that's coming up. So we're looking at a photo shoot and even a sales launch in Cormier, which would be amazing if it comes through.
Yeah, but like their kit and everything, I guess, suits what you're doing. And it's like you say, like I walk around in Berghaus and Montan and things, so I guess it felt a bit easier than just throwing on some random shoes because someone's contacted you because you were top 10 at Tour de Géants. So.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what also helped is I chose them versus them coming to me.
Yeah.
So that's a big difference. Luckily the business was at the stage where I wasn't like totally reliant on a sponsor. So I didn't have to, you know, take Hoka's offer right away. So Montaigne, I approached them, and it's been great so far.
Because I think people need to either have the choice or keep your own choice or have a relationship like you've got, or like I've spoke to other Montaigne people, and it's really good because, they're supporting you enough that you can kind of, it's a good way of working, isn't it then?
Yeah. And there's a guy who's solely in charge of kind of like just speaking with the athletes and you know, seeing what's up and checking in on them. So yeah, it's been really great.
Plus, like you say, their races seem to suit what you're looking for.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So your Tour de Géants in 2017, like you say, finished seventh in that one. Again, I still think you're probably a bit shocked, were you? Or were you gaining confidence by now? Were you there to compete, or was it just did you know where you were top 10 at that point?
So I didn't actually have any goals or anything. Oh, sorry, the goal is to finish.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's about it. In terms of placement, I didn't care. I don't even know what is going to happen out there, given it's like 3 nights of not sleeping pretty much. Mm. So, and like, it was crazy. Hallucinations and everything like that. So when I came in seventh, I was just like over the moon. I couldn't believe it. I was so excited to have finished and then finish, seventh. And then the most amazing thing is when you're in town, you get to then come back the next day and welcome in further finishers, because everyone kind of hangs around for a week, which is such a cool experience.
It seems like a really, although like you say that the website and things might not be the best, it seems like an amazing week, to even after you finish kind of thing, rather than it's not just like I've finished and then I'm back on the plane home kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So it's great that way, because the final finishing event is on Sunday,
yeah,
where the big award ceremony and you get your finisher's sweater or t-shirt, and it keeps everyone in town. And so the whole town gets overrun by just tour people and supporters.
Yeah.
And so you can pretty much talk to anyone, and you go to all the outdoor cafes and you sit down for coffee or beer, and you just see other competitors. You just, obviously you have such a bond with them by attempting something so outrageous. That's like a party atmosphere pretty much for the rest of the week.
And so completing Tour de Géance, is that the only one that you've gone back to again and again? As in big
authors,
yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, it is.
So what makes you go back to the tour? Is that kind of, again, was it you knew, again, when you're going through 3 days plus, there must be so much room for improvement, whether you're finishing top five or 500, whatever kind of thing. Is that part of it? You just want to go back and do it again better? Or is it you think, or was it just the whole experience?
So, I think you're exactly right. I think it's actually both. It's the amount of stuff you can improve on, especially in a 200 miler. Like, your entire sleep strategy is its own category of coming up with a strategy that can work. So the amount of stuff I could improve, because I went from, I think it was 84 hours the first time to 74 hours. So I chopped off 10 hours of time, which is insane, just by knowing the course, know what to expect, like nutrition and then sleeping. And then also training more specifically for the event.
Yeah.
So I think it was just so fascinating for me to go back and try different things. And there's not a lot of research out there to what people do for sleep strategies in 200s.
No.
So it was kind of like you're doing the research yourself and trying different new things. So it was so fascinating to try it over and over and over.
Because I guess some people will do really well. They seem to be able to do really well on almost no sleep. But I think more and more there's people that do sleep and doing really well in these longer races, or sleep earlier anyway, that kind of thing. So it's really interesting.
Yeah. I think it's totally down to the individual person.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know. But for me, it works to sleep minimally in like 20-minute sections.
Yeah.
So the second night, I'll take a 20-minute sleep. And the third night, I'll take a 20-minute sleep. And that's it. And I can kind of get through. I am losing my mind at the end of it, but I'll make it to the finish line.
Yeah. So how much kind of harder do you think? Well, not harder, but because you're taking a 20-minute sleep, but you're done in kind of, you're still done in 75 hours, right? So there's guys out there for days longer. Do you think, because I always think sometimes finishing towards the front of a long race can sometimes be not easier, that's different, but it's just such a completely different challenge to the guys at the back. And he kind of, I always think, they're going through so much different things, going through all the same things but times 10. It's just, I think that's fascinating as well in these long races.
Yeah, absolutely. I've never done it over, because you can take almost 7 days to do the tour.
Yeah.
So the guys who are finishing last, like, I feel so bad for them. I'm sure they have it way worse than I have it, because it might be momentarily more painful or whatever, losing my mind a little bit more, but they're doing it for 4 more days than I was doing it for.
Yeah.
So I can imagine it being much more rough for them.
They might just be enjoying the cheese and
Speaking of, like, well, yeah, because Debbie Martin Consani was giving me a hard time, like, oh, you're milking this so much, you finished so quickly, like, you were hardly out there.
Yeah.
But then I was saying, but you were just having teas at the aid stations and, like, sleeping.
Yeah. I spoke to her about the spine before the spine, and I feel bad because I said, oh, good luck at the weekend, Debbie. You've picked good luck, you picked an easy year weather-wise kind of thing. And then obviously the storm came in and everything.
Yeah, that was so fun tracking. Yeah, Debbie did really well.
So that takes you went back to the tour, you finished second. I know from, I really like the way that you do like your Instagram, what was called like mini blogs, like the review of the tour and things. So you kind of, you won't post that much, I've noticed, but it'll be kind of almost like an extended blog of day one or night one kind of thing.
yeah.
Is that on purpose, or is that just, have you written it and then you go back and do it kind of thing?
So I think it just best suits, like, I just can't sit down and write a lot. So I literally write one and leave it. And then like when I have time, I try and come back to it a couple of days and not try and leave it for too long so that I would just forget it.
Yeah.
And then I'd come back and write the next bit and then write the next bit. Cause I can't sit down and write a whole bunch, like a whole race report, like some people do on a blog or something.
No.
I'd never get around to it. And I think, I just need to, well, kind of like the tour, I need to chop it down into more manageable bites so I can actually talk about it.
Yeah. And it's kind
and of, also, and cause I'm not very good at Instagram. So it also takes up a lot of time because in my off season, all I'm doing is like indoor training. And so if I just posted a bunch of pictures of indoor training, I don't think people would like that very much.
Cause you still spend time on the bike as well, don't you? Like on an indoor bike, is that right? Have you got like a proper bike set up or is it?
Well, it's just my bike that I put on a smart trainer.
Yeah. And is that on purpose? Do you just like the bike or is it specifically for training through the winter and things?
Yeah, it's for training through the winter when it's just like motivation isn't that high and I can't, like, getting out at 6 a.m. when it's dark and raining is just, and running through the streets, yeah, it's just not that great. And also the bike trainer allows me to get really specific workouts that I want to get done because you can, it's amazing for being able to change what you want to do. So you want 10 minutes in Z2, 3 minutes in Z4, you can get exactly that by programming this workout into the smart trainer and it'll adjust the resistance to give you the perfect workout or whatever workout you're looking for.
I think cycling way more than running is good for that, isn't it? Kind of being more specific with workouts. It's really difficult with running. Even with heart rate and things like that, it's so variable. Whereas when you've got power on a bike, power readings and things like this, it's way more specific.
Yeah, exactly. And also I find it's just a nice break for the body to ease off of running for me, at least after such a intense summer than like a race like the Tour, just to let it heal up and get ready for the next season.
And have you got any kind of, do you want to do any of the big sportives or the big long bike races that they have out in Italy and stuff?
I'd love to. I did the Marmont once, which was amazing.
Yeah,
they're so much fun, and that atmosphere around that too is incredible. It's kind of like a Tour or UTMB atmosphere, even bigger probably.
Yeah, I've been speaking to Robbie Britton recently. He's just done a couple of the big, the big long bike races out there, and it's didn't look too much fun because it was kind of going over the mountaintops in kind of minus 10 and stuff, but. But yeah, some of those, like, I'm not a massive biker, but those kind of things really interest me because it's all kind of going back to the old way of cycling and all that kind of stuff.
I was following his Pyrenees adventure. I don't know if he actually completed it, where he was going to bike right across the Pyrenees.
Yes, I think he did.
Okay.
Yeah, he did. He did two like big long stage races. The first one he didn't complete, and he went back and did a second one and did the second one. He got too cold on the first one, he was telling me.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah,
I'd love to do that stuff. That stuff looks so fascinating.
And so last year, I'm going to bring you up because we're going to have to talk on a bit about the Dragon's Back at least because I did it as well. So by now, if you finished second in Tour de Gence, if you're going to races like you went to Madeira and Dragon's Back and things, were people expecting you to do well now? Is there different pressures involved in racing, or you're still managing to just enjoy it?
So, well, I definitely enjoy it. And I don't know, maybe it was the lack of communication with Hoka, but I never felt any pressure because I never really felt a part of the team when I was with them. But with Montaigne, like, they don't put any pressure on me, and they don't say like, you have to do this race or this race. They're totally laid back that way. But I do inevitably put more pressure on myself because I'm like, oh, they're giving me all this kit that's amazing and quite expensive.
Yeah.
So I feel like I need to really do well. And I think actually that's what went wrong in Madeira. because I really had a bad race at Madeira, even though like the result was okay, but I managed it poorly. I went in dehydrated and just kind of blew up again in the first 3 hours and then kind of walked it in afterwards.
Yeah.
So there was added pressure, but I tried not to think about it. And by race time, I'm always trying to say like, you know, all the work is done. Now I just need to just race, you know, half smart, and then they'll just get the result that I've trained for.
Because also kind of 2018, you either winning races locally, UK, second in the tour. So I guess it's kind of, but you're not, I don't think from looking out anyway, you're not over racing either. Some of the events you're doing, they're big events. So some of these guys, I guess, that do find themselves getting sponsorship and things, they increase their racing too much. Whereas you're doing big, long races, and from the outside, it doesn't look like you're over racing. Is that on purpose, or is it just like time and family kind of reasons?
I think it's yeah, you're right. It's probably a good thing, but it's time and family. Like if I didn't have kids and a wife, I would probably be over racing for sure, and overtraining definitely.
Yeah.
So that's probably a good thing. Yeah. It's a regulator, self-enforced regulator.
Yeah, I got some better results after winter was born, like kind of thing, because. Like you say, I'm self-employed, so in theory, I could train like a professional athlete, so I've got free rein to overtrain as well. And I think
that must be so tough.
Yeah, well, what, self-employed?
No, like trying to regulate how much you can train, because you could be out there every day for 5 hours, and that would be not a good thing.
I work with a coach myself, and that's as soon as I knew that I was having a kid, I got a coach, basically for that reason, because I know enough about it as well that a lot of people might get sponsorship and things like this. And what got them there to having the sponsorship and the race wins is usually increasing volume and just working harder to an extent. And then they gain this kind of support. They get more time off maybe and things like this. And then they just overtrain rather than resting more and things like this. And then the guys at the real top, they seem to get it really right. So they value their rest more. And although we're kind of dealing with families and things, it's kind of enforced race from training, isn't it? Which I wouldn't tell Charlotte that it's a rest, but but it's that thing, isn't it?
I know some of the top guys in the UK that happened to, like, well, I'm sure you know some of the guys who got a sponsorship, stopped working and overtrained, and now they're doing like not as well as they did previously.
Yeah, and they pick up.
But I think it's also different in my situation where my sponsorship is not monetary, so there's no money involved. It's just kit and race entry.
Yeah.
And maybe like a little bit of travel for like a sales conference or a photo shoot. So the guys who are living off it, they have totally different pressures. So I'm just super fortunate enough to have a job with flexible hours that does support us.
Plus it allows you to kind of, you have that time away from running. I know what I'm like. I'm not 24 hours talking to people about running and things like this. I do my work, do my training, and that's kind of it. It's not every evening, and my friends couldn't give two things about my running kind of thing. They don't even get it. So I think that's quite good as well. Well, family helps with that. You definitely come home grounded. You finish a long run, you're kind of knackered. You think you've kind of done something that people might not be out doing. You get home and it's like, right, got to go upstairs and play in the tent for half an hour or something like that. It grounds you quite
quickly. Yeah, in the tent. Yeah, exactly. And you know, dress up as a fireman. And
yeah, you can't just lie around after your long runs and things. You keep moving. So 2018 is done. You finished second. You didn't have, from what I gathered, the best experience at Madeira. But you've got Dragon's Back race just, what was that, the month after? Something like that?
Yeah, it was really close. Yeah, about a month.
And the Dragon's Back race went really well. And I think that's, so if you want to hear more about the Dragon's Back race, I'd listen to your Montan podcast, because you go about it, speaking about how you had a little battle with Jim, then you end up running with Jim. And you're planning to run Andorra with him now, is that right?
Yeah, that's right, Euphoria this year. So that's going to be the big race for the first kind of half of this year. That's in July.
July. Okay. So is everything geared to that now?
Yeah. So all the races leading up to it and training will have that in mind. So that's the A race. And then I'm doing the Highland Fling and the Ultra Trail Snowdonia, the 50 miler. And that's solely to lead up to Euphoria.
I'll be at the Fling too, so I'll see you at the Fling.
Ah, amazing.
Yeah. Have you been up to Scotland before running?
No, never. So this is the first time. And it's been on my bucket list to do this because it's such a famous race.
Yeah.
And I've just never gotten around to it. So I just got to do it.
Yeah, you'll love the support. That's kind of, you'll enjoy the run because it's quite runnable. It is runnable. But then, yeah, it's crazy support. It's like one of these alpine races just up in Scotland support-wise.
Oh, really? But just in terms of crowds and volunteers and stuff?
I mean, when you, especially at the finish, there's like the big long, it's quite famous, the red carpet. It's kind of five deep with people all with the cowbells.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah, wow. It's crazy. And then the support from the marshals and everything, you finish and they kind of take you over to have a nice warm shower and they look after your kit.
And then everyone, and they shower you and stuff?
I think they do, yeah. They weren't meant to, but... Yeah, it's just really good. It was a bit, I did it 2 years ago and it was a great experience. And apart from running through Scotland, they go absolutely crazy for that race up there.
Oh, that's amazing. Can't wait.
So everyone's geared to that. What else have you got in the future this year then? Is that because after July, I guess you can't look too much further than that?
It's kind of up in the air. Yeah. So I'm thinking about the Montane Yukon Arctic Ultra in January of 2021, it would be, because that's quite a long one. So if that does come through, which I'm going to have to commit to shortly, I'll then gear up the bottom half of 2020 to lead up to that race.
Yeah, okay. And I guess, because I think people are going to want to know about the spine as well. I think, have you got plans to run the spine in future if it's not the Yukon?
Yeah, I think so. I think after seeing the weather and how tough it was this year, I really actually, it's on my bucket list now. I think I've got to try it.
How did you find the goat? Because I guess that's, a lot of people use that as a kind of warm up to it, the Cheviot goat.
The goat was shocking because I thought I knew what bogs were before going there.
Yeah.
Like kind of on the Dragon's Back, we had that a little bit where I knew it wasn't bad at all because it was fairly dry. But there's that day two, I think it was, where, you know, yeah, we were running across the kind of semi-boggy terrain, especially before the halfway point.
Yeah.
So I kind of thought I knew what bogs were, but I've never been like up to my like shoulders in bog before. It was ridiculous because I had, there's this guy running in front of me, actually John Kelly, who won the spine. So he's running right in front of me. And he went like head deep into the bog, because you can't tell because the path with its stones are going, and then like it looks like just flat water that's over top of the stones, but there's actually no stones there. It's just really, really deep bog. But I couldn't stop because it was slippery, so I just like pile in after him. So if someone just saw us, it would be like two guys on top of each other in a bog.
Was it a bit of panic about how to get out, or was it?
We had to kind of pull each other out because he was quite stuck one time. I think he had to wait for people to come by and pull him out. Then you just crawl out. It's just like, what are you, this? I can't believe this exists.
Because you seem to kind of, I think you ran with him for a bit, because I had some members that are coaching it. So I was watching the dots going around and it seemed like you and John were together for a bit, but you weren't at the front of the race for a long time, actually, were you? I think it was the second half. Were you just chilling with John, or did you decide to push a bit harder, or was it just you were struggling with the bogs kind of thing?
Yeah, I was just struggling and just going. You know, I wasn't chilling. I was going kind of like as hard as I could. I always try and have an even pace. It'll never happen in ultra, really, for me. But I try and have a very even energy output. So I don't think I'll ever be in the front for most of a race. It's always in the second half when I start to make up relative time on people because they start slowing down more than I'm slowing down. And so John is actually a much faster flat runner than I am. So there's the first part of the goat, which was very boggy and hilly. So we're all kind of together. There was about eight of us. And then it got flat at the top of Cheviot. Or it's slightly downhill, but it's mostly flat on like the stones. And apart from the bogs, you can run it. So John and everyone else was quite a bit faster than me on the flats. So I just let them go. Then I was running with John for a bit. Yeah, we're just chatting, talking about the tour, because he did the Tour de Géant as well this last year. So chatting about that, chatting about his spine attempt coming up. And then sort of around the halfway point, I left the aid station before him. There's one aid station the halfway through. Left it before him, and I just never saw him again.
Okay.
And then I didn't see anyone for about 3 hours, and the fog rolled in and didn't see anyone. And I'm just kind of like, everything looks the same, like same bog stuff. And my feet are getting cold because it's like, you know, getting really windy.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden the fog left, and Adam and Simon, who are first and second, were right in front of me. And like, okay, he's in, like, I could throw a stone and hit them close to me. I was like, whoa, what are they doing right here? And then so I caught up with them, chatted with them, and then ran with them for a bit. Then, then that was the race.
Yeah, so it was a good result in the end. Yeah, first place.
Yeah,
first place. So yeah, this year that just tell us a bit about that to finish. Tell us a bit about the race in Andorra, because I don't know if everyone will know about that race. It's a team race, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a team race. You got to be in a team of two. It's navigating, because their famous race is the can't remember what it's called actually. Cima del Ronda or something.
Oh,
I might be making up totally. So their famous race is the 100 miler, which is a traditional mountain ultra, but the Euphoria is about 250 kilometers long, and you have to navigate yourself. So you make your way around the course. It's kind of like the Tour, you know, when the gun goes, the first one back, and you circumnavigate the entire country of Andorra, the little country of Andorra. So that's why it was super appealing to me to do something like that. And Jim is good company, as you probably know from Dragon's Back. He's a funny guy, fun to run with. So, yeah, we're really interested in it because I've never done a team event before.
And are you going to be able to get any specific training in for that, or running with Jim at all, or is it kind of doing your own thing until you turn up?
I would like to do that, but I think it's probably going to be just turn up and hope for the best, because Jim's got a little one as well. So he's pretty busy.
And he's busy as well,
Yeah, with his little guy. Because he was supposed to come to the Chibi Goat, but didn't show up because he's too busy with work and with his little fella.
Okay.
So, I should actually get in touch with him because we should. I'd love to. Obviously, the ideal situation would be show up 3 weeks early to Andorra, get the elevation sorted, and then run the course a bit. But with work and family and stuff, I don't know if that's going to happen this year.
Yeah, that's what kind of like my coach is. I'm doing that TDS this year with.
Oh, nice.
So he's like, yeah, ideally you need to be out there 3 weeks early to acclimatize and everything. I'm like, I'm not sure that's going to swing kind of thing. It's like summer holidays over here, and it's like, I'd love to, but also I can't take them over for a month as well. It's like...
right, exactly.
Yeah, but I think it's all part of it, isn't it? I quite like just turning up a day or two beforehand, this kind of thing. I don't have to worry about it as much then.
Right,
I'm going to leave it there, Galen. Thanks a lot for kind of covering all your training, telling us more about the races, and even more importantly, I guess, where you started from. And it wasn't too long ago, was it? So I guess you're still early in the running career. But yeah, I guess I just wanted everyone to hear the fact that you still worried about that first run. You were out in your basketball shorts and things like that, just getting it done. And then little by little, now you're kind of second in the Tour and running these amazing races.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. It's been great talking. And I've got a question for you though, Gary.
Yeah, go
when on the last day of the Dragon's Back, and you had those ridiculous sticks you were running with.
Yeah.
Ooh, what was that? What was that for?
So I had a little bit of a wobble on day one. I had a dizzy spell and things up on Trifan.
You mentioned it. Yeah.
Yeah, kind of thing. So I had a massive headache. So day two was, I kind of had a better day. But day one and day two is where I should have done my best, I guess. So then when it came to day three, I just kind of pushed a little bit too much, I guess, trying to get time back and making mistakes. And I just felt a little bit of pain in my shin, nothing at all. Day four came along and it's more runnable, I guess, isn't it? This is like a runner's stage. I started day four, went up, and what happened actually is, you go past the big, was it the wind farm things?
Yeah, on the top, yeah.
Yeah, and there's a turn off. You had to climb over the little fence and where the footpath. I actually carried on and followed these two guys straight up the hill. They'd missed it. I wasn't paying attention, just followed them for about 2 kilometres up. Realised we'd gone wrong when I saw them climbing over a fence. And rules, but kind of being rules, I thought I can either do that. That's technically cheating. It's like we'd been warned about this, climbing over all kinds of stuff.
Oh, right, yeah.
So I doubled back to the trail. And as I was doubling back, because I'd left earlier than you, I saw you and Jim just like running through the wind farm thing, basically. So then I pushed hard because it was hard ground running. I don't know if you remember on day four, you're kind of going slightly downhill. It's wide.
Yeah, on a dirt trail, right? Dirt track, exactly. Yeah.
So I start running hard down there. And then as soon as I hit like the tussocky ground, just the shooting pain up my shin, I kind of just overextended. And yeah, the whole, like the tendons just became inflamed. And it was one of those injuries that I instantly knew that's kind of game over. But yeah, and it was, so I got to the end of day, that's day four. That was before halfway kind of thing. Just in agony, but still able to run, if that makes sense. But every climb I'd be walking, every downhill I'd be walking, and I could just about run on the flat. Went to the physio tent, and they kind of, I said, it's kind of one of those conversations. I know it's kind of screwed, but can you tape it? Can you tape it up? And then that morning, I couldn't get from the tent to the toilet. Yeah, I just couldn't get from the tent to the toilet, but I started day five. And basically, like I said in the podcast, it was because I knew that Charlotte and the kids had already left to come down to meet me. So it wasn't of like, I was never not going to start day five, but it was just horrendous. So linking back to why I had those big sticks, so obviously had this injury, and I love poles. I use poles all the time kind of thing. But back on registration on day one, before day one, they basically said my bag wasn't waterproof. So I had to replace the bag with one of their wet dry bags. But it was a scuba bag, right? So it was waterproof, but it has a zip. And I'm not going to go into that. But anyway, I had to tip everything out and kind of get everything back in. And mine was the last bag onto the bus for registration. They were like, we need to get it on. And it just, because everything didn't fit the same way, I just left the poles. So I left the poles out, left some of the other stuff out, because I thought, in reality, I know I can run this race, which might sound daft to people, but it's a runner's race. Did you use poles? I don't think I saw you with poles.
No, I didn't use poles.
No, so I knew I didn't really need them. But I had them, so I left them in the car, and then obviously that's what happened. Going out the first climb on day five, there was just a pile of them on the side of the road. These branches, so I thought, right, I'm going to break some of the stuff off, because they'd been chopped off, but there's just some little branches, and I had the only blisters I got all week, they were all over my hands from having those things. it made it kind of, it took my mind off it as well, because everyone was making a big fuss of these big massive sticks that I had. But it was really good. Everyone was offering me their poles, and they could see I was injured. But people were trying to give me their poles and trying to give me all sorts. But I was like, well, no, it's all right now. I'm quite attached to them. And I kind of.
Attached. You still have them.
Well, we've come this far. And in my head, I was thinking I would hate to happen what's happened to me to those guys that were offering me the poles, because it still could happen to anyone. I was like, I'm quite happy with these kind of thing. And that's the story of why I've got those big, massive branches.
That's so funny. So I remember you just coming across the finish line with these ridiculous, like, trees that are like 8 feet tall.
Probably the first kind of time I ran. I ended up with compartment syndrome in the leg, and it just ballooned up and blisters all down from the knee down from the treatment. It was just, it got a lot worse after the race, but it's one of the only times I've been, like, every step was like that sickening feeling of whatever. But because I knew what it was, I knew it wasn't, if it was a break or something, you just couldn't continue. But it was just, I'm progressively going to make this worse, and then I'm just not going to be able to run for a bit. That's about it. So it wasn't kind of, I knew it wasn't too serious. Although afterwards, my physio and things were like, I should have been hospitalized for it to be drained and things. Yeah, but I just stayed in South Wales for a bit of a holiday, and they gave me some crutches, so I didn't really think too much of it. But it did get worse before it got better, yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, cheers, mate. Anyway, I'll catch up maybe before the fling, or at the fling, definitely.
Okay, sounds good.
Cheers, I'll end it there, mate. Thanks again. Okay, there you have it. That was my conversation with Galen. Hope you enjoyed that. I definitely did. It was, I'm just doing conversations that I would like to listen to, and it was really good chatting with Galen. He made it really easy. He's really honest, and he's and he's funny with it. His Instagram, like I said, is brilliant. Doesn't post too often, but when he does, it's really interesting to read how his races have gone and his race reports and an insight into his training. So that's at Galen Run. Go and follow him. And I'm hoping to get some more good conversations in the future if this keeps working, which it is at the moment. I'm getting some good reviews and positive feedback. But any feedback is good, good or bad. So keep it coming. You can send me a message on Instagram, is probably easiest at the minute, or my email is gary@therunstrongclub.com. Someone did send me a very funny voice note on Instagram this week, which I wasn't sure, I didn't know you could do, but I can't play it on the podcast, unfortunately, a friend of mine. But it did spark an idea. If you've got any funny stories to do with running or anything that you might want to share, you can do it anonymously. I won't put your name. Leave me a voice note on Instagram. We might see if we can get some together. Okay, next up, episode 14. We're on a roll. Thanks, everyone.